Dr. Daniel Lee is a lecturer in French history at the Queen Mary University of London. He's best known as an historian of the Second World War and a specialist in the history of Jews in France and North Africa during the Holocaust. He's been at Oxford University as a postdoctoral fellow and at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. His first book was to do with life for French Jewish people under the Vichy regime, and it's his second book that's got the literary world talking a bit more. It's called The SS Officer's Armchair. We'll let him tell the story of the armchair and the SS officer. They say this is a tale that confirms the notion of evil being banal. I suppose it does, but it confirms a bit more than that. And it's a detective story involving remarkable and painstaking research. Hello, Daniel. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Jim.
9 years ago or so, a woman took an old armchair for re-upholstering in Amsterdam. You then met this woman at a party in Florence in Italy. I wonder, Daniel, if you could take up the story from there for us.
Absolutely. So I was fresh out of graduate school. I moved to Italy. And then one evening, my roommate and I, we had a few people over, and it suddenly spiraled. And by the time we knew it, there were about 30, 40 people, strangers in our flat. And all of a sudden, I just met a young woman who was also at this university studying law. And she said to me, "Oh, you're a historian of the Second World War, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, the most remarkable thing just happened to my mother." And I was like, "Well, What could possibly have happened to your mother? You know, this is like, you know, the 21st century. How could something just have happened to your mother?" Anyway, so as you say, she told me about her mum had just taken this old armchair that she had purchased in the 1960s to get reupholstered. And, you know, she'd had it for 40 years. The kids had grown up and, you know, trampled all over it. It was falling apart. So she took it to a guy in Amsterdam to get reupholstered and left it. And a couple of days later, when she came back to collect it, the guy was really angry. And he looked at her and presented her with all these documents in his hand and said, like, "I don't do work for Nazis. You know, why are you bringing this chair to my shop, my store?" And he presented her with all these documents covered in swastikas and was just like, "Oh, is this your dad? Who is this guy?" You know, and this woman was just sort of like totally bewildered, thinking, you know, "I have no idea who this guy is. I bought this chair when I was a student." So this young woman just said to me, you know, "All of these documents belong to one guy, one Nazi. Who is he? And how on earth did his documents end up inside my chair that I've been sitting on, you know, doing my homework my whole life?"
And then you started off on homework of your own.
Well, yeah. So she kindly agreed to post me in the mail all of the documents that had been discovered inside the armchair. Everything was in the name of one man called Robert Griesinger, who was born in Stuttgart in 1906. And, you know, the name meant nothing whatsoever to me. I had to look online. I could see from the documents that he had spent the war in Prague. So, I looked in a few books, did a bit of digging, and, you know, there was just nothing whatsoever on this guy. So I just thought, oh, gosh, you know, here we have a story. You know, it's like an interesting, perhaps, person, but, you know, there's nothing on this guy. So there's not much to do here. But nevertheless, I still sort of persevered and, you know, went to a few archives because I was genuinely interested about how on earth his documents did end up inside an armchair. And I wanted to see if there were any clues. The papers that were discovered, the Nazi papers, were Griesinger's most personal papers, the kind of things that nobody could live without, especially not during war. You know, we're talking about passports, stocks and shares that had never been cashed, PhD certificate, you know, your kind of absolute identity, all bound up and sewn together in one cushion.
Without any mention of his affiliations with the SS, they were absent, weren't they?
Yeah, there was no indication whatsoever that he was even a Nazi.
It's amazing what that led to. It led to a whole book. In hindsight, from your research, do you suspect, although you've never found out for sure, have you? There was no way that you could find out why he hid the documents in the armchair. What's your best guess?
I have thought about that question every day for the last 8 years. These documents were so tightly, so well sewn into a cushion that they were able to withstand 50 years of, you know, kids sitting on it and jumping and, you know, kids alike with furniture, that I wonder whether a man of his class, you know, somebody who I'd really researched now, someone of his very sort of upper middle class, conservative background, very wealthy, would someone like that have even known what to do with a needle and thread? My hunch, if I had to bet, would be that the documents were hidden at the very moment that Prague was liberated. So in May 1945, I know that he was still in the city on the day that Prague was liberated. I know he wasn't able to get out. But my goodness, if you were German or even looked or sounded German in Prague on that day, you know, your life, you didn't have much longer to live. You know, the Czech people had been under a brutal occupation in Prague and elsewhere in Bohemia and Moravia for 6 long years. They had really, really suffered, especially under Heydrich and then some of the other appalling tragedies that befell the Czech people. So the moment that the Red Army and the Czech partisans arrived to liberate Prague, you know, anyone, Germans just were looking for safe houses. They were trying to escape. They were doing anything they could not to fall into the hands of the Czechs or the Red Army. Some of the stories we have from that time, some of the beatings, the chaos that was unleashed on ordinary German men, women, and children at that time were just utterly horrific. Maybe he thought, okay, I'm going to put these in here and come back and retrieve them once all this has subsided. You know, these people at Giesinger, he was not a monster. He was not born evil, of course not. But I think by following somebody ordinary, what it really does is offer us all this chilling reminder of how people like him, and not monsters, were actually responsible for creating the Nazi regime and were able to commit so many of these heinous crimes.
Before I get back to him and the way he evolved into being a Nazi, the thing is, as you say in the book, the Nazis didn't just run the Second World War with, you know, Messerschmitts and Panzers. They required a vast civil service apparatus that he was part of. And many of these civil servants, if Hitler hadn't come along, would Daniel have been peaceable, even liberal? And yet they all conspired to make possible dreadful acts.
Well, I mean, someone like Giesinger, perhaps not. Because he, as I've alluded to, he came from this extremely conservative military background. Okay, Giesinger, he's probably not a member of the Nazi Party. He probably didn't even vote for the Nazis, let's face it. But goodness me, the one thing which was at the top of his mind was to stop communism taking control. That was the thing that feared him the most. And if the Nazis were going to put in place actions that would prevent the spread of communism, then yes, he would sign up for that. And he would turn a blind eye to many of the things that the regime was doing. In no way would he have considered himself to be a liberal. So it was better to have the Nazis than, you know, many other alternatives that could have existed at that time for someone like him and of his class and background.
He lived in a liberal area, though. I think you make that point. And I know that he may have had his upbringing in a more nationalist military family than most. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to find analogies today because he was accompanied by, you know, thousands and thousands of other civil servants. Mm-hmm. And maybe if the local police started rounding up the beggars on the streets to take them away and kill them, and I just kind of made a note of this and was a bit perturbed and got on with my day and thought, oh, well, that's the way things go now. I mean, I know his politics were pretty nationalistic, but he seems to have been a perfectly personable sort of chap.
Absolutely. Like so many of them. I think that's what's so amazing about somebody like him, because, you know, just by reassembling his life in the way that I did, I can quite easily see how men like him of his generation, it was an effortless the switches he made from being this very kind and gentle and funny on the one hand to displaying his complete cunning and indifference at other moments. You know, while he was working at the Gestapo in the mid-1930s in Stuttgart, at the same time he was getting married, he was starting a family and building a life for himself.
And that is the fascination of your book. Isn't he an example of those who weren't particularly interested in Hitler before the Nazis gained power and were not interested in doing much to mitigate the atrocities that followed? Life just carried on mostly quite comfortably.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody like Giesinger, absolutely. As I've said, he was able to turn a blind eye. One thing that marked somebody like Griesinger, the thing that marked his youth, was the humiliation of the First World War, what had happened to Germany, what the other countries were doing to Germany. This is what marked his teenage years, all he cared about as a teenager. And the reason I know this is because I was able to find his mother's diary. All he cared about as a teenager was restoring German nationalism, German pride. And so by the time we get, you know, by the time this guy is, you know, mid-20s, late-20s, and the Nazis are coming to power, and he looks and he sees, okay, I probably wouldn't have voted for these thugs, but at the same time, look at the solutions that they're offering.
Yes, but as you say, he consigns people to death from behind his desk in that Gestapo headquarters, and dreadful things happen to those brought into the building, but he just carries on with his administrative tasks. I think that's what we today can't really get our heads around.
He would have been responsible for sending out orders for Gestapo agents to make sure that the laws were being enforced. So he would get an order from Berlin, for example, and make sure that the law was being enforced locally. And yes, he would have made, he would have been responsible for rounding up various opponents of the regime. So especially early on, we're talking about communists, social democrats, anyone who sort of would have opposed the Nazis. And then later, it would have been Jews. He wouldn't have actually seen with his own eyes. He wouldn't have gotten his suit dirty when people were being tortured. When I was in Stuttgart, I talked to some elderly people who said that even today, they can't walk past the building. They avoid it. They take another street because of the stories they heard as children about what actually took place in the torture cellars in the basement of that building. Nobody like Griesinger would ever write, you know, you must round up Mr. Bernstein and torture him downstairs. No, there would be a very coded, a very special way of talking about this. And that's how people like Griesinger were allowed to prosper. That's how the system was able to work.
Dr. Daniel Lee is our guest. His book is The SS Officer's Armchair in Search of a Hidden Life. Your own family suffered in the Holocaust, and Griesinger coincidentally was there or thereabouts during a mass killing when some of your relations were murdered.
That was so startling to ever think that I would in any way find anything interesting about my own history when researching the life of this ordinary Nazi. You know, I'm a professional historian, I'm objective, I don't, you know, this isn't family history in any way. But when I saw that Griesinger was involved in the attack in June 1941 on the secret attack on the USSR, and as I look at Griesinger's route into Ukraine towards Kiev, he just suddenly one day in July 1941 just enters Tarasha. We have this myth, this post-war myth in Germany of soldiers who are fighting against the USSR, German soldiers. So they would go in and the German soldiers, the Wehrmacht, would do all their fighting, this sort of gentlemanly fighting, and then move on. And then suddenly the killing squads, the German killing units would emerge, and it would be up to them, not the soldiers, to massacre the local Jewish population. But I think in the last 20 years, what we've seen is that this is completely out of date, this view, and that a lot of ordinary soldiers were very, very involved in massacring the local Jewish population. His exact unit was responsible for massacring Jews in Western Ukraine, where my family came from.
I suppose what we want to know is how far evil awaits under the veneer of polite society and how contagious it can be once it surfaces. Because that's what I will remember most from your book, I think.
Yeah, it's just so... You're absolutely right. How evil were these guys? I mean, of course, now with hindsight, and of course at the time, what they were doing was horrific, and it was wrong. But I wonder, in the eyes of those who were closest to them, you know, to use words like evil and these were words and feelings that would never have come up when thinking about these men who were fathers, who were lovers, who were sons. You know, and that's what's extraordinary for me by looking at other sources surrounding these men. So to see how his mother wrote about her son, to talk to his daughters, to see how they remembered their father, from this time. Nobody's describing anything to do with evil at all. And I don't think that that's how these men at the time would necessarily have seen themselves. You know, Griesinger died in 1945. So his daughter, he left behind a wife and two young daughters who had this very sort of idyllic childhood. You know, Germany, they were in Stuttgart. Stuttgart wasn't being bombed, really, until 1943, at which point they left for Prague. And, you know, to be in Prague, it was just like a dream posting. They had a wonderful childhood. They had a wonderful family life. Everyone in Hitler's Europe wanted to be in a place like Prague, you know, with the wonderful German architecture and cinema and, you know, the German schools and what have you. So Griesinger's daughters had a wonderful childhood. And so for them, their father was this remarkable, extraordinary, kind, loving man who loved his family, who loved animals. But after the war, they could not find out anything about him. They tried to ask their mother. Like so many Germans, it was impossible. There was this veil of silence that hung over post-war Germany. So many young people, you know, really wanted to know about the past, but these German, the Germans of that generation, they developed these amazing, amazing strategies for sort of deflecting, you know, oh, dinner's ready, or oh, hold on, you know, nobody, they just wouldn't talk about what had happened during the war, especially in the 1950s and 1960s. It took a very long time. So his daughters did try to ask questions at first, but they were just shut down and were told not to think about it. So they grew up without a father, and they just had this idyllic sort of image of their father until I came along. They would sort of answer my questions, and then they would ask me questions about their father. Oh, what was he doing here? What was he thinking about this? Why did he do such and such? Why did he stay in Prague? So it created this very curious dynamic between us.
If Griesinger hadn't died in that hospital in Prague from whatever disease, if he'd lived to be an old bloke and you'd, say, caught up with him in Argentina, what would you have wanted to ask him most?
What a good question. I highly doubt Griesinger would have ended up in Argentina. Just like, you know, so many of these big guys at the top, these killers, they're the ones who often escaped. There were very, very few Nazis who were actually tried. When we think about it, at the end of the war, very few punished, and so many were amnestied in the late 1940s to try and get Germany back on track. So I'm sure Griesinger would not have changed his name. I'm sure he would have returned to Stuttgart. If I had ever met him, what would I have asked him? Why did he join the SS? Was it something that, you know, we think it is now because it has this glorified image of this elite organization? I mean, one of the groups I read about had, it was something like there were, I think, 8 men or something like that, and they were preparing for an SS feast, and they had 90 minutes to peel the potatoes. And by the end of the 90 minutes, they'd only peeled 12. You know, these are meant to be the elite men who are going to take Germany forward over the next generation. You know, what was going on at these meetings? Was it something they really believed in, this new racial hierarchy? Or was it just, oh, God, I've got to go to the SS on Tuesday, otherwise I'm not going to get promoted. Like, what did they, did someone like Griesinger actually believe in the message being put out by the SS? Or was it something that he just dipped his toes into from time and time just to keep up with everybody and make sure that he would receive a promotion at work? That's what I would like to know from him.
What you also examine, though, is not just dipping your toes in, it's the detail of hardcore racism. You know, it isn't Confederate statues, it's the racial science you must minutely apply in order to decide who is worthy or who is not. I mean, it's all very well having master races, but the application of the theory always founders when you try and make it practical, as the South Africans discovered with apartheid. For example, can you tell us what Griesinger and his wife Gisela had to do to get married?
Obviously, race is a determining factor for the Nazis, who could be and who couldn't be part of their new society. And so for the Nazis, as we know, you know, people with Jews and people with Slavic origins, etc., there were lots of people who weren't able to play a role in the society that Hitler was trying to create. And it was very important for the SS, especially for Himmler. So Himmler took complete control over the marriage requests by his SS men. both he and his future wife, Gisela, they both had to produce family trees showing that, you know, there was no Jewish people or Slavic people in their lineage. But then also Gisela had to sign away confidentiality from her SS doctor. She had to go to an SS doctor and have the most extraordinary tests conducted on her to make sure that she would be able to bear healthy SS, you know, children worthy of an SS bride. It took him almost 6 months in order to get married, just to be able to jump over all of these hurdles to prove that he and his wife were racially desirable and that they would produce racially desirable children. And we do have lots of stories of other SS officers in those cases of either giving up their wives or future wives if they thought that there was a problem in their lineage. You know, if so-and-so had found a Jewish or two Jewish grandparents or something, then there are many cases of SS officers breaking up their engagements at that time to further their career.
And the Grieslingers had Jewish neighbours at one point, didn't they?
I mean, that was a huge... I just blew my mind when I saw this. The next door neighbour, when I'm looking through the registries, the name is Rothschild. And I was like, you must be joking. You know, the houses were detached. They shared this very thin wall between them. So both couples would very easily have known about the movements of the other. And this is exactly when Griesinger is working for the Gestapo at this time in 1936, just as his next door neighbor, Fritz Rothschild, is still working in his textiles business. And he was a veteran of the First World War. And a lot of these veterans from World War One, Jewish veterans, they really, really thought that the anti-Semitic legislation were for other people and that they wouldn't be affected. And that, you know, oh, anti-Semitism, it's come and gone in the past in Germany. Why will this time be different? You know, we've had all of these like little Hitlers before. We're veterans. We've spilt our blood for work for Germany. This isn't going to affect us. And so someone like Fritz really thought that that would have been the case for him. And unfortunately, things did not work out that way for him. He ended up being rounded up in Kristallnacht, and shortly after, he and his wife and son fled to Paris, and they spent the war in Paris until they were eventually deported to Auschwitz.
You know, you've just used the phrase there, these times have come before. I suppose my final question is, can these times come again? Because we see revived anti-Semitism discussed in recent years more and more. And it obviously lay underneath the surface, not just of life in Germany, but of all of Europe, you know, for centuries. I suppose that is the real worry. Have we learned from the Holocaust sufficiently? Have we learned enough for it to be obviated now?
I think, you know, we're living in these very, very strange, dark, in some ways dark times, Jim. So I do wonder how much we've learned. Look, there's, of course, amazing work that charities and schools are doing, trying to teach about the Holocaust. But there's, as you're alluding to, there's, you know, there are constant revivals of anti-Semitism in various forms, in ways that people are saying, oh, well, you know, this isn't anti-Semitic. It's very hard for people to take a look at themselves in the face sometimes and say what they're doing might be anti-Semitic. But I think one thing that we're talking a lot about in universities at the moment, and of course elsewhere in the world because of Black Lives Matter, this extraordinary historical moment, you know, we are living history right now. And it's up to us, you know, future generations, I think, will look back at this Black Lives Matter moment and really sort of think, what did they do as the statues were falling, as certain events were going on around the world? The opposite of being a racist person isn't to say, you know, oh, I'm not racist. It's to be, I am anti-racist.
And there are still these huge ideological gulfs visible in society, aren't there? And you wonder how on earth they can be resolved. It's not just the racist, anti-racist. There's so much disagreement across the chasms of opinion, and we live in uncertain times.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult moment. I mean, who could have predicted, you know, what would be going through, you know, the world in 2020? You know, I remember at the beginning of this year, you know, we were so devastated by seeing those horrible images of the fires in Australia. And that just seems like such a long time ago when we think of all the things that have happened to us as a planet in the last 6 months, I think all of us need to start really thinking about our role in this world and what we can do to make things better for our neighbours.
All fingers and toes crossed. Daniel, thank you so much for both the interview and the book, The SS Officer's Armchair, In Search of a Hidden Life. And we've been speaking to historian Daniel Lee. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.